Welcome to the Epigenetics Podcast from Active Motif. Join host Dr. Stefan Dillinger for lively discussions with leading epigenetics researchers. Hear about their past experiments, what they're working on now, and what's coming next. You know their papers, now get to know them and discover the stories behind the science.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Epigenetics Podcast. Today I'm happy to welcome Sara Marazzi from the UK Dementia Research Institute at Imperial College London on this show. Please let me briefly introduce you to audience. You got your PhD from King's College London in 2017. After that, you moved on to do a postdoc at Queen Mary University of London. Then in 2019, you became honorary senior lecturer at Imperial College London. And since 2023, you are senior lecturer and UK DRI group leader at King's College London. A question I like to ask every guest to start off our little podcast is, how did you become interested in biology in the first place and then in pursuing a career in science?
Oh, well, so for me, it's slightly different because my background is actually in mathematics originally. And in my early undergrad days, I thought I'd become a pure mathematician and work on such wonderful things as algebraic geometry and topology. But I realized throughout that degree that it was a bit too abstract and too isolated for me. As a mathematician, you basically work on your own, essentially, even at professorial level. And I also felt like I would like to apply my skills to something that is meaningful to me. And so I ended up writing my master's thesis on epidemiology and biostatistics, medical statistics. And as I then was looking for PhD projects, found one really exciting one at King's College London with John Mill on epigenetic analyses of brain-related diseases. And I had a particular interest in the brain. I'd also done a second undergrad in psychology. So it sounded really exciting. They were generating these big data sets of DNA methylation data across various time periods in human development and different conditions, including Alzheimer's disease and dementias in the late age, but also an interest in what happens in the early life as we're exposed to various different stressors psychologically or more physically. And basically, I came in as someone who was predisposed, I guess, to analyze these big data sets, high dimensional data, advanced statistical modeling. And then really found my passion in that realm. And as I was doing the PhD, that's when the realization came, this is what I want to keep doing for the rest of my career.
Yeah, let's just dive in straight into your science that centers around, as I said, epigenetic regulation in neurodegenerative diseases. At the start of your career, you were part of a study where you investigated severe psychosocial deprivation in early childhood. So what does this actually mean? And what did you find about the connection between this and epigenetics?
Right. So, there are lots of theories around stress of various types leaving long-term imprints in our body in some way. And there's really good epidemiological evidence that people exposed to severe stress will later on develop psychiatric, psychological issues, but sometimes also more somatic diseases. And this is particularly true if they experience this in early childhood, because it's a particularly plastic developmental period. However, it's not known what the biological substrate of this memory is in our body. And so there's been a lot of excitement, some might say hype, around the epigenome as the memory that retains these signatures of stress exposure and then later on leads to adverse psychological and health outcomes. So the study that you mentioned was a really fascinating cohort of children adopted from Romanian orphanages. So in the 1980s, under the Ceausescu regime in Romania, there was a huge increase in population, partially because abortion was outlawed and contraception was made really difficult. And there was a push to grow the country, but the economic means were not there. So a lot of children, unfortunately, were given into institutions that were very poorly funded and poorly run. So these children were exposed to things like malnutrition, neglect, basically no adults to really interact and take care of them, no stimulation, both emotionally and cognitively, poor hygiene, and sometimes even active abuse and maltreatment. And so in the 1990s, this made the news across the world. And from several countries in Europe, there was a big push to adopt the children. Sir Michael Rutter at the time, he was a psychiatrist at King's College London, set up the English and Romanian adoption study, where he recruited some of these children that were adopted into the UK into a longitudinal study to understand future development for children that were growing up under such severe poor conditions. And so they recruited some control UK, within UK adoptees as well, but then also even within the Romanian cohort, the children would have been exposed to different periods of time to these, to the institutional deprivation. And so in that context, we studied DNA methylation of some of these adoptees. And this was saliva, buccal swap DNA methylation, to see whether we could pick up any signatures of duration of exposure versus differential DNA methylation. So if you're exposed for a really long time, then you're predisposed to adverse future outcomes as well. And the cutoff seems to be sort of 18 months, where it gets much worse. So if children are adopted before the age of 18 months, they'll probably catch up fine afterwards. But if they spend longer than that in the orphanage, a lot of them will have long-term adverse outcomes. And so we found some differential DNA methylation, but one in particular that spanned a whole region of one of the cytochrome genes, CYP2E1, and this is a gene involved in metabolizing various different things. It has, including I think alcohol and some other medications and compounds, but that's also been associated with depression and antidepressant use in the past, so that was quite interesting. And so in our study we found that children exposed longer to the institutional deprivation show differential methylation across this region, and equally symptoms of what we would call quasi-autism, which is basically an inability to read emotionally understand other people and infer what they intend to do, was also associated with a differential methylation above and beyond what was just explained by the deprivation exposure, so potentially as a mediator of that effect.
So this was like a whole bunch of actions applied to the kids, right? It's not like a single isolated thing that you were looking at, but it's like a whole bunch of actions here.
That's correct. And and it's probably one of the most severe exposures all around that you would get in a natural context.
So what you then did is indeed looking at like a single thing. I mean, it's not like a single thing because it's the whole diet, but you looked also at early life diet and how this would affect like the epigenetics later on. So what did you see there?
So that was very different. This was then during my postdoc, and that was at Queen Mary University, working in the lab of Vardman Rekian. And so before I even joined, they had shown that in the mouse, protein restriction diet can cause epigenetic changes, but also potentially something interesting going on with regulation of ribosomal DNA. So really, I spent 2 years in-depth investigating the part of the genome that encodes the ribosomal RNAs. And this is one of the most difficult parts of the genome to study because, in fact, when we were doing it, the clusters hadn't even been mapped out. So ribosomal DNA basically occurs, is encoded in a 45 kilobase region that occurs in repeat clusters. And each cluster can have up to 100 copies or so of this 45 kilobase repeat. And humans have our DNA clusters on 5 different chromosomes. So all the acrescentic ones, the one with one really short arm, have these RDNA clusters.
That make up the nucleoli.
Sorry?
That make up the nucleoli.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. They are the nucleolar associated regions. So they're in very specific compartments. And we know if we map, say, DNA from the ribosomal regions to a consensus ribosomal unit, we can see that there is clearly genetic variation occurring across the ribosomal DNA, although within the RNAs, it's quite limited. It's relatively conserved. There are some variants that are in the coding regions, but then you have this intergenic spacer that's in the region, and that there is a lot of genetic variation in there, and it's not entirely clear what the function of that is. But it seems to be that some copies of rDNA are expressed, others not, and that there are dynamic mechanisms in particular, in response to nutrition and metabolism, that can regulate how much rDNA and which copies of rDNA we use. And that, again, will involve DNA methylation. So there's a really complex interplay. And that's what we saw in those studies, that depending on maternal, early life nutrition, protein restriction, the mouse will respond differentially to it. And then it turns out, actually, there's a whole genome-wide context as well. So this seems to differ between different mouse species as well, depending on the length and how many copies they have to begin with. And that will influence the plasticity.
So you just mentioned that all those early life influences on the childhood, they reflect in the DNA methylation.
Well, that's one of the theories. that's right.
Is there also histone modifications that might be involved?
Well, I mean, I would argue probably yes, because I think chromatin and histone modifications often represent maybe a more direct response to gene regulation that we can pick up. I think the reason why it hasn't been done or hasn't been shown as much is that it's harder to study and more expensive to study. So a lot of the work that's going on in these big epidemiological population cohorts will use DNA methylation because it's easy to extract DNA and run DNA methylation arrays, and it can be done pretty high throughput. Whereas I think with histone modifications, you need a better lab setup. There's not as much of a service going on. It costs more money. And so I think histone modifications are beginning to be looked at in epidemiological contexts, but more for tissue and cell type specific things. So I know several groups that, as we are now, are working on the brain for various both psychiatric and neurological conditions. And there we've been, there have been some really, really interesting findings with epigenetic annotations. And I think one of the most striking things is that we consistently see that genetic risk for a lot of complex diseases, specifically brain diseases, neurological diseases, is quite specifically enriched in regulatory elements and particularly enhancers. So really, if we want to understand what these non-coding genetic risk variants are doing, we need to be studying the enhancers. We need to be studying the histone modification code and the annotation. We need to understand what cell type is a given variant active in. So if it's an enhancer, where is this enhancer active? Which target gene does it regulate downstream, and into which sort of bigger picture networks and pathways does it fall?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is very complex indeed, and needs, I mean, ATAC-seq is maybe a good method to start with, which is also comparatively easy in comparison to histone PTMs and DNA methylation on the other side. But yeah, it's very complex. You then switched gears a little bit into investigating neurodegenerative diseases. In the first paper from Nature Neuroscience, you looked at H3K27 acetylation in Alzheimer's in a histone acetylome white association study. Complicated word. So how did it come that you moved into the topic of neurodegenerative diseases, and what did you find in this study?
Actually, that had been sort of my passion and what I had wanted to do since the beginning of my PhD. So when I set out, my PhD wasn't planned through into the last detail and all the projects set up. But we talked vaguely about some brain-related phenotypes, epigenetics and epigenetic signatures from brain samples, ideally. And so I'd really been wanting to do an Alzheimer's study the whole time. And ever since I started and I was going to these conferences, reading literature, I was really interested in histone modifications because, like I said, they seem to link more directly to gene expression. And I was surprised that nobody had looked at them really in the context of diseases, because it's challenging. And so my lab had already done a big DNA methylation study of Alzheimer's disease and found some really interesting differentially methylated sites in the brains of people with Alzheimer's. And I basically said, why don't we do this with histone modifications? And so the idea was there since the onset of my PhD, but it took some time to develop and find the right collaborators. And so we nailed down on H3K27 acetyl because it is very interpretable. When you have increased acetylation in enhancers and promoters, that means increased expression. It is pretty much exclusively found at promoters and enhancers. So these are quite clear and well-known regulatory elements. And so that's the one we went with. And I found a collaborator who was very experienced in ChIP-seq experiments at the time and helped me optimize this. So we ran this study. And it was actually my very first time doing lab work, having come in as a mathematician. And in retrospect, now that I run a lab that does both experimental and computational work, I am kind of shocked how little went wrong in that project and how smoothly it all went through. But I put it all down to my excellent collaborator, who was very experienced and taught me very well. And then analyzed this data and actually saw that there was really widespread dysregulation and changes in acetylation, much wider than anything that had been seen at the DNA methylation level. So we saw thousands of regions that showed differences between the Alzheimer's cases and controls. And some of those, quite interestingly, were linked to Alzheimer's risk genes, but even familial Alzheimer's risk genes. So Alzheimer's basically occurs in two forms: familial, which is maybe 5 to 10% of cases, in which case you harbor a mutation in one of three genes. And that's either APP or the two presenilin genes, presenilin 1 and 2. And if you have such a mutation, you will develop Alzheimer's disease and you will develop a form that's earlier onset. So you're likely to get the disease maybe in your 50s rather than late 60s, 70s, 80s. But that accounts for a smaller proportion of cases. Most people get what is called late onset Alzheimer's disease, and there are genetic contributions to that, but it's not as simple as one mutation, you get the disease. But it's thought to be more of a polygenic disease that also acts in combination with environmental risk factors. So all of our cases were late onset cases, no mutations, and yet we saw epigenetic dysregulation in these same genes that normally harbor the mutations associated with familial Alzheimer's. So we thought that was quite striking and interesting, and suggested maybe to some degree that an epigenetic insult to those same genes can lead to a later onset form of the disease.
Which would open therapeutic possibilities, right?
Potentially, yeah. But I mean, at this stage, these are all association studies, and there are a number of caveats to consider. For example, you're always sampling the very late stage of disease because these are brains from brain banks, postmortem samples. So they're collected when the person dies, which usually means they're at a very late stage of the disease. So what we're picking up is going to be a combination of maybe causal factors that are driving the disease molecularly, but also a lot of responses to disease. And we know that there are a number of things going on in the late stage Alzheimer's brain, including quite severe neuroinflammation, and that's going to have an impact on your brain epigenome as well.
So you just mentioned that in this study you used ChIP, but you also dived into the topic of cut and tag. And you compared the amount of peaks that it is able to recover compared to encode ChIP-seq. This paper is still a preprint, but it's specifically interesting because on this podcast, we from time to time also dive into the details of new methods and also get a bit philosophical when it comes to things like what is a peak and things like that. So maybe we can spend some time diving into this. So what was your experimental approach and optimizations you made to tackle this analysis?
Right. So, I mean, maybe let me motivate it. I'm sort of, my approach to this work is quite pragmatic. I wanted the best possible way to do cut and tag for samples that we'd been collecting. And so we'd been working with a complex xenotransplantation model where you basically put human immune cells in a mouse brain, and then we can only collect a limited number of these cells when the experiment is done. And so it was obvious for us that cut and tag sounded like the right method and is definitely the right method going forward to profile those limited numbers of nuclei. But we wanted to do it well, and we wanted to find the best way to do it. And actually, most of the literature at that point had been published on methylated histone modification, so mono or trimethyl histone modifications. And so with the acetylation, it was a bit trickier. And some of the feedback we got from some other labs that we talked to was basically saying, maybe the cut and tag signature for acetylation is a little bit noisier than the one that we would get for, say, H3K27 trimethyl or H3K4 trimethyl. So we went through a number of experimental and computational optimizations. So experimentally, we first of all tried a bunch of different antibodies, antibody concentrations. We did different numbers of PCR cycles. We tried including different more stronger and weaker HDAC inhibitors just to make sure that the activity of those deacetylases is not limiting or influencing our outputs. And then we also did some different DNA extraction methods, so either column or SDS-based. Overall, most of the factors didn't make a huge impact. For example, the HDACs, and that was my previous experience with CHIP as well. It was something we were worried about in the beginning with our any samples, in our case, the post-mortem brain samples, but at that, maybe those samples are, when they're frozen down and dead, the deacetylase doesn't seem to be doing much anymore. So we came down to some conditions that we, in basically qPCR-based optimizations, saw as the optimal ones, and then went ahead with sequencing a whole bunch of these libraries, and doing some computational optimizations as well, because, of course, cut and tag was relatively novel. Traditionally, for ChIP-seq, people would use MAX2 as a peak caller. But then there are a number of new peak callers published. So at the time when we started this project, one called Seeker, but there have been even newer ones since then that are specifically targeted at cut and tag or cut and tag and cut and run, because they have a different signal to noise ratio. And so you probably need a different mathematical model or background to identify what is enriched and what is a real peak.
Sorry to interrupt, because right now you're talking about like optimizations in the protocol, but what about optimizations in the sample prep? So what did you use at the beginning? How many cells? What did you do to them?
Right.
And how can this be optimized?
It was pretty straightforward. We were working with K562 cells at the time because we wanted something where we have a lot of published data that we can compare to, such as ENCODE data. And we were working with plenty of material because we wanted to start from the best case scenario. In fact, I think we probably started with maybe too much material. We started with 500,000 cells in those experiments, which we, for our own purposes, now that we're running experiments, we wouldn't do anymore. When we do this in the lab now, we're probably on 50 to 100,000 cells or nuclei. What was your other question?
That was it. So what did you do in the sample prep steps and what did you do to leading up to the experiment? I mean, if you're using K562 size, then I mean, it's basically straightforward. So
exactly. So we thought one step at a time, let's start with an easy material and then we'll deal with lower quality materials such as post-mortem tissue when we get there.
So yeah, you stopped at the peak calling and the benchmarking of cut and take against ENCODE ChIP-seq.
Right. And so there was an interesting outcome from this, which is that overall, as we turned the data around and we even used some of the original published data from Steve Hanikov's lab, who developed the method, obviously, that there is never a perfect overlap between the ENCODE ChIP-seq and the cut and tag. And I guess maybe that's not to be expected. I mean, in an ideal world, the techniques would be completely replaceable and give us the ground truth of where the histone modification binds. But that's obviously technically not the case because the techniques are different. You have the cross-linking step in the chip that might be changing things and changing the epitopes and the binding of the antibody. You have more background noise. So I guess you wouldn't expect a perfect overlap, but in a way we were a little bit surprised by how low the overlap was. So in our best conditions, it was maybe just over 50%. We have recently done some more experiments and done each of the conditions in triplicate just to be like super sure and in new hands and separate experiments. So I think our best overlap is now at 60%, but it doesn't really get higher than that. And there's a trade-off, a natural trade-off between how many of the ENCODE peaks that were called in ENCODE are you recapturing in your new data set versus how many extra, if you will, spurious peaks are you including? I mean, because you can play around with the peak calling parameters, especially with this peak caller seeker, you can make it more lenient. You'll call more peaks, then you'll capture more of the ENCODE peaks, but you'll also capture more extra things. So that's a bit of a challenge. And what we've tried to do in our work is try and basically threshold it as we want maximum 20% of extra spurious peaks, then how much of ENCODE can we recapture? But again, I mean, just because they're not in ENCODE and they're in cut and tag, does that mean they're spurious? You said you have had previously quite philosophical discussions about what's real and what's the biology. We've been having these discussions in the lab for years, and we were thinking about what are the methods that we could use. We thought about looking at luciferase assay data, but that's very confined to specific regions. We would like a genome-wide metric, if you will. We were looking at some starseed data, but again, that's limited and then only captures some regions. Overall, I mean, the overall message is basically, even though the overlap is not perfect, when you look at things like what transcription factor binding motifs are enriched and how correlated are the samples, they do overall seem to be picking up the same things. And importantly, the peaks that are the strongest will be there in both of the techniques, right? So we think biologically meaningfully, you can use both techniques and they are equivalent. But when you do make direct comparisons, you need to take into account that each technique is different.
So did you also look at the peak shape? Did you also look at the peak shape?
We did a lot. I mean, generally, the peaks are fine. What we do observe is that the acetylation of the cut and tag is noisier than the methylation. So in the methylation, you get these classic, really quite concise peaks with very little background noise. That's never quite as concise in the acetylation. And then the overall signals, where the peaks will be called, seeker will tend to combine multiple peaks into one. So it will take signals from what Max2 would call as a set of separate peaks that are very close to each other, and it'll read it as one peak, even though when you look at the track, you see there are different individual and geographically separated peaks, if you will. We're just generating a very large Alzheimer's study again from purified brain cell types, where we'll have 200 samples almost for each cell type. And one of the things we're noticing, the problems exacerbate it the more samples you add. So one of the things we've been doing traditionally is when we call peaks for ChIP-seq data, we combine samples together because it improves your power to detect the signal over noise. Now, when you do this with cut and tag data and you combine, say, 30, 40 samples together, and then you use Seeker to call peaks, it becomes almost absurd because it starts calling these peaks that are a megabase long or something like that. It calls very, very few enormous peaks. So clearly, that method isn't well adapted for using this approach of combining samples together, but was devised for calling on individual samples only.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, so we're currently thinking about how can we best leverage, and we might in fact actually go back to Max2 because of that for these scenarios where we would like to combine multiple samples together. Because if you have 200 samples, you're interested in what's the overall set of peaks, say in your first cell types, say you're looking at neurons, there will be an overall number of maybe 100,000 or so peaks that you would expect in a ChIP-seq data set. That might not be equally strong or there in all the samples, but that are sort of the general peaks. And then you look at for signal differences between the samples, and calling them on each sample individually is a very inefficient way of getting to those neuron specific peaks over a large sample.
Yeah. So what I was wanted to get at, but you did kind of wiggle around that, is when you look at a single peak in ChIP and in cut and tag, yep, I have observed that you get like a nice shape peaked in ChIP, but you maybe get the dip in the middle when you do cut and tag. Have you also seen that?
Huh. It's a good question. I'm trying to remember. I'm not sure we've quantified this overall. So what we do usually quantify is this enrichment around the peak center, mm-hmm, or also enrichments around transcription start sites. And there, I think the cut and tag peaks are a bit more concise, and I don't think we've seen any dips. But okay, you're catching me out a little bit because I cannot confirm 100% that this is something we have seen or not seen in the cut and tag data.
Okay. Do you also see some shifts of the peaks, or is it always the peak summit at the same place?
Across samples?
For one peak, yeah. I mean, yeah.
It's pretty consistent. We do see the noise can vary a bit, but the peaks that are there are very consistent. So overall, it's actually, I mean, I guess the preprint that we put out caused quite a bit of debate and discussion. And it was sort of try to be critical, but not in a negative way. We're excited about this technique and we're using it a lot ourselves. We just want to try and use it in the best possible way. So it's definitely working well in our hands now. What we're saying is you just have to be careful with how you analyze it and how you cross compare maybe different data sets.
Yeah. So last question, I promise, to this. So this was uploaded in BioArchive in January 2023, and now is March 2024, and it's still not published.
Yes.
So what's going on?
That's right. So in fact, we submitted it to two different journals. So we always put out the BioArchive first, and then we went to review in two journals. And we got some concerns raised that we are addressing experimentally right now, including that we're generating more replicates for each of the conditions that we have. So we're going to have everything in triplicate. In fact, we had a non-anonymous review by Steve Hennikoff, who was a bit worried about some of the metrics on our data. And now, so we, in fact, over-sequenced some of the samples a bit, which had to do with our sequence. It's not what we were planning to do, but there was apparently space on those sequencing lines. So our sequencing service ended up giving us sort of 100 million reads or
okay,
in that range for some of the samples, which in turn means you get huge duplication rates. And then it looks like the sample quality is poor and the library complexity is poor. I think the ground truth is somewhere in the middle. So when you downsample those, the duplication rates are lower. I do think the ones we get now after a few years of experience with a technique are a bit better overall, and we wouldn't choose to sequence 100 million reads per library for a cut and tag experiment. That doesn't really make a lot of sense. In fact, we'd probably go for 10 million to be in a good space, or if we want to do like more subtle differential acetylation, maybe 20 million. But yeah. I think there you're already in like very high coverage territory for cut and tag. Yeah.
So moving on again to dementia research, you were part of several publications that wrote about machine learning and AI in dementia research. So the one keyword is the DEMON network. What is it that those approaches can bring to the table in dementia research?
So the DEMON network is sort of now an international network of scientists working in dementia and using AI machine learning methods, but across a whole range of different subdisciplines. So you have, for example, people who work on imaging data, and I think their machine learning approaches have been around for longer and are maybe a little bit more advanced. So using both structural and functional brain imaging data, for example. Then you have people who wear on such things, work on things as wearables and trackers, devices that measure, for example, your heart rate or sleeping data, and then use that to predict disease onset, disease progression, all sorts of different things, how you deal with the treatment. Our own work, I guess, is more in the space of the genome, genomics. How can the genome explain disease, or how does genetic risk work, and how does it mediate intermediate molecular phenotypes such as epigenetic patterns? But also to some degree, and this is a paper that I led on, and that's a big challenge in the field, is how do we translate between different systems in which we model disease to human disease? So because brain diseases are extremely difficult to study in the human, and generally you only study them with post-mortem tissue, so by the time the person has already died, there's been a lot of work going on in model systems, often mouse models of disease that may have genetics, either full genes knocked in or genetic variants that are in the human knocked in, and they recapture some degree of the disease. But actually drugs that were discovered, if you will, in mouse models have a very poor rate of translation to human clinical trials, and often they'll fail in the human trials, even though they work in the mouse models. Increasingly now, people are also using in vitro models, so modeling different brain cells or even co-culturing various cells together in the dish. There you have the problem that these cells are often quite embryonic in their nature, so their epigenetic signatures would, of course, represent a much more earlier developmental stage. And we're dealing with diseases of late age, where age is one of the biggest single risk factors. So if you look at what contributes, what increases your likelihood to get Alzheimer's, for example, age will come out as the biggest risk factor. So if you're over 90, you have a 50% chance of having some neuropathology in your brain already. And that increases as you age. So how do we model age in vitro, or how do we translate between these complex systems? And I think there is space and hope for machine learning, more complex nonlinear models that take in a lot of data and learn associations that we might not very simplistically see to come in. So there's been some development. I don't think it's been solved, certainly for cross-species translation. I think some of the most exciting things we are seeing are more around analysis of different types of genomics data. For example, a lot of analysis tools for single-cell sequencing data that can generate embeddings of existing data sets. And so if you're generating a new small data set, you can harmonize it and embed it into a much larger data set, and thereby improve the power of your own data set, the clustering approaches. We've been doing some work and with other collaborators as well at predicting things like gene expression or epigenetic modifications from the DNA sequence itself and layering cell type specific information onto that as well. So yeah, in that space, I think we've seen, I mean, there have been a bunch of huge models that were published in the last few years, like Informer, the big gene expression prediction deep learning model. And then we had Chromoformer for the predicting from epigenetics to gene expression. So how do different histone modifications interact and how do they drive gene expression? And so I think we're going to keep seeing a lot more of those in the next few years as well.
So usually my next question asks you to imagine that you are writing a grant, but or writing up a grant proposal. But in before we started this interview, you told me that you're actually writing a grant proposal currently. So what are you writing into this?
How much of that giving you away my secrets? No, not at all. No, so this one is on. So when it's a collaborative grant, and it's about the role of oligodendrocytes, which are a type of glia cell in your brain. They're the cells that myelinate your nerve cells and the axons of your nerve. They're basically like the insulators where the conduction of electrical signals becomes faster and more reliable thanks to these fatty myelin sheets around the axons. And so one of the observations that my team, for example, has made is that in these Alzheimer's brain, when you look at histone acetylation and the dysregulation, actually, the majority of it seems to occur in the oligodendrocytes. And we did this computationally by developing a cell type deconvolution algorithm and could then infer cell type specific dysregulation. This was also more recently shown in an empirical paper from the labs of Li Weizai and Andreas Fenning, where they purified different nuclei from brains of people with Alzheimer's and controls. And again, the largest degree of dysregulation is observed in the oligodendrocytes, both in upregulated and downregulated peaks. So that was an interesting observation. Now we have some collaborators who've been studying gene regulatory networks in mouse models, so co-expression networks, and assigning them cell type specificity as well, and looking for overlaps with genome-wide association study patterns for both Alzheimer's, but also for aging and longevity. And again, they found that oligodendrocytes seem to carry a lot of that genetic risk for AD and for longevity as well. And they seem to do so in a kind of collaborative, communicative fashion with the microglia, the immune cells of the brain. So there are some neuroinflammatory, or some people call it inflammaging, component going on that the oligodendrocytes seem to be interacting with, both in aging and AD. And so the grant that we're writing is mainly computational because we're already generating a lot of the relevant data for this, but it's about teasing apart what is aging specific, what is AD specific, what are the genetic contributions to this based on statistical genetics approaches, integrating with the existing GWAS data, but also what are the sporadic contributions beyond that in AD brain and in aging brain. So we're generating these aging timelines of epigenetic profiles as well.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting. And let's see what we can read from the studies then in the future. So for the last 43 minutes, we have been on a journey through your scientific career. Did we miss something important or would you like to add something?
Oh, that's a really good question. Well, one of the things, I guess your publication record is always a few years behind of what you're actually working on. And now at the UK Dementia Research Institute, where I've been for the past 4 years or so, first at Imperial and now at King's, another big focus for our group has been environmental risk factors to neurodegenerative diseases, and quite specifically for Parkinson's disease, because it's a disease that's less heritable and that likely has greater contribution of environmental risk. And so we've been working on a number of really exciting in vitro and animal models of pesticide exposures, which are a huge risk factor for Parkinson's disease and human epidemiological work, and starting to see some very exciting epigenetic patterns associated with this. So indicating that epigenetics and histone modifications might, again, represent sort of a cellular memory of a long-term, low-grade chronic exposure to something like a pesticide that can then drive your cells in a quite cell-type specific way into more pathogenic states or predispose them to neurodegeneration. And that seems to be an interaction of both the affected neurons that degenerate, which in Parkinson's are the dopaminergic neurons of the Niagara, but also the surrounding glia cells that are in constant communication with the cell and can stress the cell or send out signals that make the neurons more vulnerable and are bad for the neurons, essentially.
So to finish, could you give us a brief summary of your most important finding? I mean, I've put the emphasis more on the cut and take study now, maybe, but what is your the most important thing that you would consider the most important thing?
I don't know if it's one finding, but I think we've been together with others really showing that epigenetic dysregulation, particularly at the chromatin level, in Alzheimer's is extremely relevant. We know this because the genetic risk for AD is enriched in these regulatory elements, actually in the regulatory elements of microglia, your immune cells. And so we are building a portfolio of research that lets us drill into where exactly, in which cell types and which activation states these epigenetic changes occur and how they relate back to the genetic background of coding and non-coding variants that are associated with the diseases. And I think, in that realm, we've made the biggest discoveries so far.
So thank you, Sarah, for your time and for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Epigenetics Podcast from Active Motif. We hope you enjoyed it. You can find all the mentioned references in the show notes. Please rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. We'd love to hear from you, so please send us your feedback on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or via email at podcast@activemotif.com, and we'll give you a shout out in a future episode. For more great epigenetics content, check out the Active Motif blog at activemotif.com/blog. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.